Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Friday, January 5th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Thorson Mithelman. And here is Jim with our first story.
All right, we're going to lead off. This is a Davenport story. Humane Society, city, still at odds. Funding for animal control is at issue. This written by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Davenport may provide animal control services in-house if the city and the nonprofit Humane Society of Scott County can't come to a funding agreement. Representatives from the Humane Society, a nonprofit, say the current cost of providing animal control to Davenport is $1.388 million. Davenport's contract, approved by the council in June 2022, agreed to an annual fee of roughly $400,000, plus a city-provided car, fuel, and dispatch radios, and funds for kennels. In August, the Humane Society notified Davenport it wanted to terminate its agreement in February because it was underfunded. After months of negotiations, the Humane Society and Davenport did not come to a long-term agreement, but did agree to continue services until at least July. And with that extension, the city would pay an additional $250,000 to continue services through the end of the current fiscal year. City Council members expressed support on Wednesday for it and are expected to vote on the extension next week. But how stray animals will be handled in the city of Davenport after July 1 is still to be determined. Supporters of the Humane Society of Scott County attended Wednesday night's City Council meeting to urge aldermen to continue contracting with the Humane Society for animal services and to increase the organization's pay. The Humane Society provides an animal shelter and animal services officers who respond to calls for assistance. Citing wanting more time to receive information and negotiate with the Humane Society, Davenport Alderman agreed to delay voting on an agenda item that would have directed city staff to form an internal animal services unit as a subdivision of the police department and negotiate agreements with shelters. I do think that more information is necessary so that we can move forward and make the best decision for everyone, at-large Alderman Jasmine Newton said before making the motion to table the vote for two cycles, which passed unanimously. At-large Alderman Kyle Gripp said he was hopeful the city and the Humane Society could still come to an agreement on a collaborative approach. Because there are ways that we can get there, Gripp said, I don't think the city writing a $1.4 million check each year out of the general fund is how we're going to get there. That's my personal opinion, but I would also like the Humane Society to continue to offer these services. Erica Gunn, the Humane Society of Scott County's executive director, told the council that the city of Davenport makes up 87% of the services the Society's Animal Protection Services Unit provides for the whole county. I understand this is a sticker shock. This is a big number, Gunn said. That's just 0.57% of the entire budget. For less than 1% of the entire city budget, animal control and animal shelter services could be paid in full. Additional funds could also help with a lack of animal control officers, Gunn said. This is where a lot of the cost is coming from, she said. It is not cheap to hire enough animal control officers to provide correct services for your city. I think one of our biggest complaints that we get is that we do not have officers responding in enough time. If we were paid appropriately, we could provide that. Other cities operate their own animal services. Iowa City budgeted $974,000. Cedar Rapids budgeted $1.361 million, and Peoria paid $1.643 million for its animal services, Gunn said. She added that each has a higher euthanasia rate than Scott County. In other business, new council members were sworn into office Wednesday by Supreme Court Justice Thomas Waterman. Half of the 10 aldermen were first elected this November, meaning there will be new faces and new opinions on the council, which faced significant personnel turnover this past fall. Newton's second ward alderman Tim Dunn, fourth ward alderman Jade Burkholder, and seventh ward alderman Michelle Lynch, and eighth ward Alderman Paul Reinerts Jr. were all elected to first terms this past November. Annie Wittenmeyer, the council is expected to hold a public hearing January 17th on whether to convey property at the historic Annie Wittenmeyer complex to a developer, Chris Ailes, whose plan would be to convert many of the structures to affordable rental housing, according to the city, including 52 units for seniors and 47 units for families. The campus includes about 32 acres on Eastern Avenue. Several structures are from the 1800s, when this property was built as an orphanage in the Civil War era. In the 1950s, it was converted for use in behavioral services, and the city took over ownership of the campus in the 1970s. None of the 1800s-era structures on the campus would be demolished under the plan, according to city council documents. The city would allow Ailes 1 year to secure funding and tax credits, and if successful, would transfer the property to Ailes by September 2025. If financing efforts are unsuccessful, the agreement would expire, according to the City Council documents. During that time, existing tenants, such as the Davenport Junior Theater, will continue either on-site or at a new location. According to Council documents, city staff have begun to explore a potential partnership with the Davenport Community School District, and the developer is offered to allow the city to lease or buy back the current theater building if more time is needed. Main Street Landing. Next week, the City Council will formally vote on a grant agreement from the Iowa Economic Development Authority's Destination Iowa program. The city received $9.6 million from the state to go towards a $24 million total for several projects, which include the Main Street Landing Riverfront Destination, Skybridge LED Lighting, Railroad Quiet Zones, and the Figge Art Museum's external lighting. The city announced the grant in 2022, which adds to $6 million of city ARPA funds, $6 million in railroad settlement funds, and $2.4 million of privately raised funds by the Figge. City staff said this agreement did not change these funding sources or the cost of the project.
Also on the front page, one killed, five injured. Gunman also dies. This is about the Perry High School shooting. It's accompanied by a photograph of a man and four children all holding hands, leaving the reunification center in Perry yesterday. A 17-year-old opened fire at a small-town Iowa high school on the first day of school after the winter break, killing a sixth grader and wounding five others as students barricaded in offices and fled in panic. The suspect, a student at the school in Perry, died of what investigators believe was a self-inflicted gunshot wound, an Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation official said. Authorities said one of the five people wounded was an administrator, later identified as Perry High School Principal Dan Marburger by an Eastern Iowa school district where he graduated from high school. Authorities identified the shooter as Dylan Butler, age 17, but provided no information about a possible motive. Two friends and their mother who spoke with the AP said Butler was a quiet person who was bullied for years. Perry has about 8,000 residents and is about 40 miles northwest of Des Moines. The high school and middle school are connected, sitting on the east edge of town. Mitch Mortvedt, the state's investigation division's assistant director, said during a news conference that authorities also found a pretty rudimentary improvised explosive device and rendered it safe. The suspect's motive is being investigated, and authorities are looking into a number of social media posts he made around the time of the shooting, Mortvedt said. A law enforcement official briefed on the investigation said federal and state investigators were interviewing Butler's friends and analyzing Butler's social media profiles. Investigators found posts of Butler posing with firearms, according to the official who spoke on condition of anonymity. Sisters Yasina Rader Hall and Kamya Hall, both 17, said alongside their mother, Alita, that Butler was bullied relentlessly since elementary school, but it escalated recently when his younger sister started getting picked on, too. Officials at the school didn't intervene, they said, and that was the last straw for Butler. He was hurting. He got tired. He got tired of the bullying. He got tired of the harassment, Yasina Rader Hall, age 17, said. Was it a smart idea to shoot up the school? No, God, no. Perry High School senior Ava Augustus said she was in a counselor's office when she heard three shots. She and the other people barricaded the door, preparing to throw things if necessary, with a window being too small for an escape. And then we hear, he's down. You can go out, Augustus said through tears. And I run, and you can just see glass everywhere, blood on the floor. I get to my car, and they're taking a girl out of the auditorium who had been shot in her leg. Three gunshot victims were taken by ambulance to Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines, a spokesperson for its health system said. Some other patients were transported to a second hospital in Des Moines, a spokesperson from Mercy One Des Moines Medical Center confirmed. Mortvedt said one person was in critical condition, but the injuries didn't appear to be life-threatening. The other victims were stable, he said. Hundreds of community members gathered for a candlelight prayer vigil Thursday evening at a park, where hours earlier students were dropped off to reunite with their families after the shooting. A post on the high school's Facebook page said it would be closed Friday, with counseling services planned at the public library Friday and Saturday. Governor Kim Reynolds ordered all flags in Iowa lowered to half staff. She said this senseless tragedy has shaken our entire state to its core. In Washington, President Joe Biden and U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland were briefed on the shooting. FBI agents from the Omaha-Des Moines office are assisting with the investigation led by the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. The shooting occurred in the backdrop of Iowa's first-in-the-nation presidential caucuses. GOP candidate Vivek Ramaswamy had a campaign event scheduled in Perry at 9 a.m., about 1.5 miles from the high school, but canceled it to have a prayer and discussion with area residents. Mass shootings across the U.S. have long brought calls for stricter gun laws from gun safety advocates, and Thursday's did within hours. That idea is traditionally a non-starter for many Republicans, particularly in rural GOP-leaning states like Iowa. As of July 2021, Iowa does not require a permit to purchase a handgun or carry a firearm in public, though it mandates a background check for a person buying a handgun without a permit. Ramaswamy said the shooting was a sign of a psychological sickness in the country. In Des Moines, GOP rival and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said gun violence, quote, is more of a local and state issue, end quote, in an interview with the Des Moines Register and NBC News. An active shooter was reported at 7:37 a.m. Thursday, and officers arrived 7 minutes later, Dallas County Sheriff Adam Infante said. Emergency vehicles surrounded the middle and high school. Xander Shelley, age 15, was in a hallway when he heard gunshots and dashed into a classroom, according to his father, Kevin Shelley. Xander was grazed twice and hid in the classroom before texting his father at 7:36 a.m. Kevin Shelley, who drives a garbage truck, told his boss he had to run. "It was the most scared I've been in my entire life," he said. Rachel Karras, an 18-year-old senior, was wrapping up jazz band practice when she and her bandmates heard what she described as 4 gunshots. "We all just jumped," Karras said. "My band teacher looked at us and yelled, 'Run!' So we ran." Karras and many others from the school ran out past the football field as she heard people yelling, "Get out! Get out!" She said she heard additional shots as she ran, but didn't know how many. She was more concerned about getting home to her 3-year-old son. Erica Joliffe said her daughter, a 9th grader, reported getting rushed from the school grounds at 7:45 a.m. Distraught, Joliffe was still looking for her son, Amir, a 6th grader, 1 hour later. "I just want to know that he's safe and okay," Joliffe said. "They won't tell me nothing." This was written by Nicholas Riccardi and Hannah Fingerhut of the Associated Press.
Thanks, Rachel. Turning to the local news page, Watermark Corners to close. It's got a picture of the store in Moline. Watermark Corners, 25-year-old gift shop in Moline, is planning to close in early 2024. No exact final date set for the downtown Moline store. This written by Gannon Hennevold of the Quad City Times. When she was a senior in college, Amy Trimble dreamed of owning a bookstore. In less than a year, she folded her goals neatly into the Trimble family business. Her parents already owned a funeral home, a stationery store, and a flower shop when Amy and her mom opened up the original Watermark Corners, a store that was half gift shop and half children's bookstore. As it grew, the stationery store eventually merged in, and Watermark became a staple of downtown Moline. Now, 25 years later, the store, still run by Trimble and her mother, Barbara, is closing. Amy Trimble said overall sales have still not returned to pre-COVID numbers, but noted that thanks to the store's control of its costs and margins, the shop's last quarter of 2023 was its most profitable in its 25-year history. "The family is hoping to end on a high note," Trimble said, refocusing their energy towards the original business, the Trimble Funeral Home, now approaching its 150th year. "When we started looking at investing in another 3 to 5 years with Watermark, with the changing retail and everything the way it is, we made the decision it was time to refocus our energies," she said. Her mother is also planning to step back on her hours and working responsibilities, Trimble said, adding she doesn't want to run the shop without her mother. Amy Trimble will be transitioning to a role as Chief Operating Officer and Director of Operations for Trimble Point Companies, the parent organization that oversees Watermark Corners, the Trimble Funeral Home, and City View Celebrations. The shop has not set an exact closing date, but Trimble said she's estimating late January or early February. Until then, Watermark Corners is holding a closing sale, which started on Thursday, December 28th, and will run as long as supplies last. Everything in the store will be marked down up to 50% off. Watermark's Corner Bar, introduced in 2023, will also be open throughout the store's last month with wine and spirits curated by Amy Trimble. The bar has happy hour on Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., and Fridays from 4 to 8 p.m. For 25 years, Watermark Corners has helped send out wedding invitations, birth announcements, and everything in between, Trimble said. So it's been an emotional week of saying goodbye. The store softly announced the decision to close on Facebook last week before the official announcement posted on Wednesday. Many locals on Facebook chimed in with their best wishes. The day after their quiet announcement, Watermark Corners was full of customers, Trimble said, just minutes after opening. They were teary and hugging and sharing memories about how we touched their lives, she said. It's been a pretty emotional, beautiful week.
Bettendorf Community School District okays Edison budget. The board approves $3 million for addition and renovations. This is by Olivia Allen of the Quad City Times. On Wednesday, the Bettendorf School Board approved the sale of Edison Academy, the district's alternative high school consortium, along with updated plans for the school's relocation. Currently located at 438 16th Street in Bettendorf, the existing Edison property will be sold for $600,000 plus other potential consideration to 1525 Brown Street, LLC. The academy will remain at the location until it can move to the new one. As previously reported, Bettendorf Schools formed a lease agreement with Alera Group, Inc., to use its office property on 3066 Victoria Street as the future Edison building, just across the street from Bettendorf High School's south parking lot in August. Excuse me. Partnering with Bray Architects, the district plans to gut the Victoria Street site for sweeping renovations, including a new secure entryway and expanded flexible use spaces. The back of the building will get a four-classroom addition connected via corridor and elevator. Now, with unanimous board approval, the district plans to spend just under $3 million on the addition and renovations for Edison, funded via SAVE, or Secure and Advanced Vision for Education, dollars. Kurt Pratt, Bettendorf School's Director of Operations, said project bidding results will come to the board at the first February meeting. He said on Wednesday, the current Victoria Street tenants are vacating at the end of the month. The building will be vacant after that so we can start construction immediately upon board approval and then hope to be done in August of 2024. Bettendorf's first February school board meeting is scheduled for 6 p.m. on Wednesday, February 7th, 2024. In October, design plans for the new Edison were also unanimously approved by the board. Pratt said Bray is finalizing all designs, drawings, and specifications which haven't really changed much from those approved in October. As previously reported, Bettendorf Superintendent Michelle Morse said she and other district leaders met with Edison administration during the planning process to gather feedback on the design. Morse said, "This team, that is the Edison staff, has been waiting patiently to have updated facilities. It was nice to show them we're moving forward." To Morris, the forthcoming flexible use spaces at Edison would be a district-wide asset, particularly because of its new, more centralized location, used for family engagement events, professional development, or other activities.
Thanks, Rachel. We go to Orion to seek well repair bids. Village Board okays $10,000 the bids. What we know, the Village of Orion is dealing with the prospect of extensive repair to its east and west water well houses and has already had a firm do temporary repairs to control panels. What's new? Trustees voted unanimously Wednesday to spend $10,000 to have Klingner and Associates prepare a scope of work to go out for competitive bids for the project. A representative from Klingner was at the meeting and promised he could get the work done and out to bid in 3 weeks. Village President Jim Cooper said Britain Electronics and Automation, which did the temporary repairs, has assured him that those can stay in place regardless of who is hired to do the permanent fix. Last month, Britain said permanent repairs could cost $163,000 at the high end. The representative for the firm that's running the village's water department, Ion Environmental, said he was all for doing a bid process. "I think we're fine running on what we're running on now," he said. Trustees also decided to label the Love Park concession stand project, until budget time, with some noting the well house project should take priority. Trustee Steve Newman said there was time to sort out financing for the concession stand project that could cost up to $160,000, with construction not anticipated until after this year's baseball season, and possibly not this year at all. So what's next? Trustee Aaron Peer brought up a major problem he said exists with the mayor and other trustees disrupting village employees. The issue came up during a discussion of closing the office for necessary training on the new G-Works software system. Peer said it's not the general public, but the mayor and other trustees that are interrupting employees by entering over the lunch hour. The disrespect is uncalled for, and I wouldn't blame any of them if they wanted to walk out, he said. Cooper said he felt his position as mayor entitled him to unlock the door and take care of business. Peer said he didn't disagree with that. Other trustees said it was an issue that should be addressed in closed session.
Thank you, Jim. Just a reminder that you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It's time now to turn to the obituaries that are in today's paper. I'll read the pending services and the first one of the obituaries, and Jim, if you'll take the other ones. So pending, Daniel or Dan Lewis Adams, age 74 of Moline, died on Tuesday, January 2nd. Cora R. Andrews, age 83 of Moline, died on Tuesday, January 2nd. Paige Bellinger, age 93, formerly of Moline, died Wednesday, January 3rd. Kenneth Bridgeford, age 91, of Coal Valley, Illinois, died on Wednesday, January 3rd. Clarice Ann Clark, age 86, of Davenport, died on Thursday, January 4th. Donna Jo Cooper, age 90, of Moline, died on Friday, December 29th. Mark Freddy Fredrickson, age 74, of Moline, died Monday, January 1st. Gloria J. Klos, age 84, of Moline, passed away December 29th. Melinda D. Roden, age 48, of Rock Island, died on Friday, December 29th. Paul Shanahan, age 84, of Maquoketa, passed away Tuesday, January 2nd. And Kimberly S. Woods, of Buffalo, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, January 3rd. From Bettendorf, Diana Virginia Meinhardt. Funeral services for Diana Virginia Meinhardt, age 81, of Bettendorf, will be 1 p.m. Monday at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Burial will follow at Davenport Memorial Park Cemetery. Family will greet friends on Sunday from 1 to 3 at the funeral home. Diana passed away on Wednesday, January 3rd at Genesis Medical Center East Campus, Davenport, Iowa. Diana was born on September 14th, 1942 in Burlington, the daughter of Floyd and Mildred Cole Woodson. She worked at Alcoa as a metallurgy technician for over 30 years, retiring in 2002. She enjoyed sewing, quilting, bowling, gardening, collecting cobalt blue glassware, and playing games on the computer. Survivors include her children, Edie Peterson of East Moline, Mark's spouse Bernadette Scharfenberg of Las Vegas, John's spouse Stephanie Scharfenberg of Russell, Iowa, Rochelle's spouse Randy O'Neill of Moline, 16 grandchildren, 7 great-grandchildren, a sister May Altman of Davenport, and a brother Ralph, spouse Linda Schmidt of Rock Island. She was preceded in death by her parents, a son Brent Scharfenberg, brother Edward Woodson, and granddaughter Hope O'Neill. Online condolences may be shared with the family at www.mcginnischambers.com.
And next we have Mark Kurvorst, who passed peacefully into the next life at the age of 66 on New Year's Day. He pursued his pursued his strong faith throughout daily Bible reading, and he will be remembered for always putting the interest of his friends and family before his own. Marty was preceded in death by parents Gerald and Tekla and brother Greg. He is mourned by his large family, including his siblings and their spouses, Donna and Stu James, Jerry, Sam, and Mary Kurvorst, Michael and Lucy Kurvorst, Kathy and Richard Forora, Mary, Chris, and Bob Dunavent, Rita and Mark Bowden, Patricia and Jim Bostian, Tony and Rhonda Kurvorst, Steve Kurvorst, twin Marla Moore, and Lori and Heinz Schamberger. A private memorial service is planned. Halligan McCabe DeVries assisted the family with arrangements. From Morrison, Orville Knox Goodenough, Jr., age 93, of Morrison, died Thursday, January 4th, 2024, at Genesis East Medical Center in Davenport. Orville was born June 10th, 1930, to Orville Sr. and Helen Montgomery Goodenough, and lived on the family farm on the Garden Plain Road, with a few exceptions, all his life. He graduated from Prairie Center Grade School and Morrison High School. In his youth, he was involved in 4-H and was a star, a state sectional vice president and American Farmer Award winner in FFA. He married his high school sweetheart, Clara Gertz, in 1950, and their marriage was blessed with three children. He served in the U.S. Army and was an investigator for the Counterintelligence Corporation. He and Clara raised purebred Holstein cattle, Oh Good Holstein Farm, and exhibited them at many fairs, including over 50 years at the Whiteside Fair, and was awarded the Friend of the Fair Award. He was a member and served on the board of directors of the Illinois Holstein Association, Rock River Holstein Club, Whiteside Farm Bureau, Morrison Historical Society, and served as an elder in the Morrison Presbyterian Church. He took barn pictures, wrote old farmer poetry, and good old days stories. In 2000, he traveled to Ukraine and Moldova as a volunteer working with farmers as part of the Citizens Network for Foreign Affairs. He is survived by his children, Kathy Anderson, Philip Goodenough, and Steve Goodenough. He is also survived by six grandchildren, Wendy Hess, Ryan Anderson, Stephanie McFadden, Amber Floyd, Megan Rangan, and Ethan Goodenough. 11 great-grandchildren, he was preceded in death by his wife, Clara Goodenough. A gathering of family and friends will be held on Saturday, January 27th from 10 o'clock to 11 a.m. at the Morrison Presbyterian Church. A memorial service will follow at 11 o'clock with Pastor Mike Selberg officiating. A memorial has been established to Stronghold Camp and Retreat Center, P.O. Box 199, Oregon, Illinois, 61061. And online condolences may be sent to www.mcdonaldfuneralhomes.com. Finally, we have Diane L. Jackson of Reedsburg, Wisconsin, age 69, passed away on Tuesday, December 5th, 2023. She was born on September 26th, 1954, in Liverpool, Ohio, the daughter of Carl Sr. and Bertha Parrish Stacy. Diane was a 1972 graduate of Beaver Local High School in Lisbon, Ohio. She proudly served her country in the U.S. Army from 1974 to 77. On May 29, 2010, she was reunited in marriage to Merle Jackson. Diane was employed as dispatcher for St. Clair Township PD and later the Davenport PD. Following her retirement, she moved to Reedsburg, Wisconsin to be closer to family. Diane was an avid reader, enjoyed browsing flea markets, traveling, and spending time with her family, especially her many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents and sister, Darlene Seifert. Diane is survived by her husband, Merle, sister and brothers, Debbie, spouse Paul Gresh, Carl Stacy Jr., Dale Stacy, Mike, spouse Diana Stacy, Tom, spouse Rita Stacy, aunts, uncles, and many nieces and nephews, along with other relatives and friends. A celebration of life service with full military honors for Diane will be held at 12 o'clock noon on Saturday, May 18th, 2024. Burial will be made in Rock Island Arsenal Cemetery in Rock Island. The Farber Funeral Home, Reedsburg, Wisconsin, is assisting the family with the arrangements.
Now it's time to turn to the opinion page of the Quad City Times. The first editorial there by Mark Thiessen, who is a political columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. It's titled, Immigrants Aren't Poison. They are America's lifeblood. To understand what is wrong with Donald Trump's repeated claim that migrants who are in the United States illegally are, quote, poisoning the blood of our country, end quote. Take a moment to watch Bill Murray's 1981 comedy, Stripes. In the movie, Murray is trying to inspire a ragtag group of losers struggling to pass Army basic training. He exhorts them, "We're all very different people. We're not Watusi, we're not Spartans, we're Americans with a capital A. You know what that means, do you? That means that our forefathers were kicked out of every decent country in the world. We are the wretched refuse. We're the underdog. We're mutts." Our country does not have a singular bloodline to be poisoned. Americans can trace their roots to every corner of the planet. Even if your ancestors came here on the Mayflower, you're descended from boat people, the riffraff of 17th century Europe. They came here for the same reasons most immigrants come today, seeking a better life than what they faced in the place of their birth. The reason we can make the audacious claim that we are an exceptional nation is because we are the first in human history not built on blood and soil, but on an idea, the idea of human freedom. Anyone, including Spartans, can become an American. Our mixed breed heritage distinguishes us. "You can go to live in France, but you cannot become a Frenchman," President Ronald Reagan once said. "You can go to live in Germany or Turkey or Japan, but you cannot become a German, a Turk, or Japanese. But anyone from any corner of the earth can come to live in America and become an American." This is precisely why we need not fear the rise of nationalism in America. In most countries, nationalism is based on ethnicity, but ours is a creedal nationalism, a commitment to the supremacy of the American idea. European nationalism is inherently exclusive. American nationalism is inherently inclusive, open to those who come here legally and accept our creed, our constitution, and our founding principles. Today, our creedal nationalism is under assault from both the left and right. On the left, some are trying to convince us that America is a systematically racist country that isn't really all that great. On the right, some self-styled national conservatives are seeking to foist European-style blood and soil nationalism onto the American body politic. This is inimical to our founding principles. The Declaration of Independence says that all men, not all Americans or all U.S. citizens, are created equal. Although we have sometimes failed to live up to those principles when immigrants come here and jump into what we used to call the Great American Melting Pot, they can become as American as any of us. Fortunately, most Americans still believe this. According to a Gallup poll from July, a 68% supermajority say immigration is a good thing for the country, up from 52% in 2002. Just 27% of Americans consider it a bad thing. The problem at our southern border is not that so many people want to come here. It's that many are coming here illegally. It's that our government lets millions of people enter without screening out criminals and those who wish our country harm. It's that transnational drug cartels take advantage of the porous border to flood our country with deadly fentanyl. It's that economic migrants abuse the asylum system and crowd out actual refugees. It's that the border chaos makes it impossible to reach bipartisan consensus to fix our immigration system. But the fact is, we need legal immigrants. There are 8.7 million unfilled jobs in the U.S., and there are not enough native-born workers to fill them. According to Census Bureau data, the U.S. population is now growing at less than replacement levels. The only thing stopping us from overall population decline is immigrants, who are projected to account for 88% of U.S. population growth through 2065. Far from poison, immigrants are a life-saving transfusion into the American bloodstream. That includes the Trump family. The former president is descended from a mix of German and Scottish immigrants. His grandfather came here in 1885 as a 16-year-old German barber, while his mother was a domestic worker who grew up in hardscrabble circumstances in Scotland. His children by Ivana Trump and Melania Trump are German-Scottish Czech or German-Scottish Slovenian mix. His grandchildren on the Kushner side have a Polish-Jewish background, and his grandchildren by Eric and Lara Trump have Slovak, English, German, Swiss German, and Dutch heritage. Like most of us, the Trumps are mutts, and this is the real source of American greatness. Reagan told us we lead the world because, unique among nations, we draw our people, our strength, from every country and every corner of the world. Thanks to each wave of new arrivals to this land of opportunity, we're a nation forever young, forever bursting with energy and new ideas, and always on the cutting edge, always leading the world to the next frontier. Yes, we urgently need to secure our border. But the moment we start worrying about the purity of our blood, we will abandon what makes us exceptional and become just another country. And that is no way to make America great again.
Thanks, Rachel. And our second opinion piece, written by Steve Corbin, who is Professor Emeritus of Marketing at the University of Northern Iowa. Outlook of America's Political, Economic, and Social Fabric. Before we get too far into the new year, let's review the immediate past, present, and future of America's political, economic, and social fabric. Despite a recession being predicted to occur in 2023, Janet Yellen, U.S. Treasury Secretary, reports, number one, Federal Reserve actions brought inflation down from 9.1% in 2022 to 3.1%. Two, 2023 annualized growth averaged around 3%. 3. New business startups were at a record pace. 4. The unemployment rate fell below 4%. And 5. The typical middle-income households had higher earnings, more wealth, and more purchasing power than before the pandemic. This comes from the Wall Street Journal, December 12th and 21st, 2023. Research reveals four economic measures paid off handsomely for Americans. Number one, $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. Number two, $1.75 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Number three, $1.2 trillion Inflation Reduction Act. And number four, $280 billion CHIPS and Science Act. The economic reward includes the American economy producing more goods and services, up 2.6%, and wage gains outpaced inflation and will be even more significant in 2024. The year 2023 also witnessed, one, the crime rate went down. Two, U.S. carbon emissions fell below 2007 numbers. And three, all three major stock indexes soared dramatically, boosting the retirement savings of more than 150 million Americans. The year 2023 is the first time in decades people could earn around 5% from their savings and money market accounts, which increased the financial well-being of tens of millions of people. This information from the Wall Street Journal, December 30, 2023. Presently, we're witnessing a boom in cleaner energy, and the cost of metals used to make batteries will continue to remain low in 2024. Additionally, strong oil production growth in North America and increasing global refining capacity will keep gasoline prices down in 2024. While the U.S. debt ceiling was raised by Congress on June 3, 2023, the GOP-controlled House has passed only seven of the 12 appropriation bills they promised to approve in the fall national debt problem. It grew $8.2 trillion, a 40.4% increase during Donald Trump's presidency, and $1.8 trillion, or 6.3%, since Joe Biden has been president. For the future, CRINC is the new acronym patriotic and democracy-loving Americans should remember: China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. The CRINCs show no sign of easing up on cyber attacks, nor infiltrating America with disinformation, misinformation, social media propaganda, artificial intelligence interference, and fake political ads similar in 2024 to the 2016 presidential election. CRINC's implicit and explicit war against Ukraine, Taiwan, Israel, Hamas, Gaza, and the United States, to name a few, will continue. A strong president who opposes CRINC dictators versus honoring their autocratic leaders is paramount. When the Supreme Court goes back into session on January 5th, all Americans hope the justices will decide, one, what presidential immunity means, two, what defines interfering with the counting of electoral votes, three, do states control the election process, four, is a president an official of the government, Article 1, Section 3 of the Constitution, five, was Mr. Trump engaged in re-election activities or presidential duties when he did nothing for 187 minutes during the January 6, 2021 Capitol attack, and six, was the January 6th attack a normal tourist visit or a planned insurrection coup? While the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June 2022, Pew Research Center polling shows 62% of Americans support pro-choice rights. Besides women's right to reproductive health decisions being a 2024 election dealmaker, immigration reform will also implicitly be on the November 5th ballot. Bipartisan deals on immigration have eluded lawmakers and presidents for three decades. Knowing Congress is so divisive and the asylum law is complicated, politicians will most likely kick the can down the road and claim the $300,000 monthly migrant issue will be settled on November 5th. Common sense knows better. For the record, former President Trump had only 517 immigrant judges on the bench in 2020, and President Biden increased that by 42% to 734 judges. There are 75 million indigenous Native Americans, Alaska Natives in the United States, 2%. Since the remaining 98% of Americans are descendants of immigrant families, it is ironic and a sad state of affairs when the benefits of immigration are questioned and our elected delegates can't resolve the issue. Finally, after November 5th, Americans will know whether they remain a democracy or have reverted to living in a populist, authoritarian, dictatorship-driven country. Issues to be reached. A multitude were not identified in this op-ed are plentiful. 2024. Here we come, ready or not.
Thanks, Jim. We only have about a minute, a short little article from the sports page from Iowa Football. DeJean entering NFL draft. This is by Dave Selvig. Iowa All-American defensive back Cooper DeJean is entering the NFL draft. Expected to be a first-round pick, DeJean missed the final three games of Iowa's season due to a leg injury suffered in practice in mid-November. According to ESPN draft analyst, DeJean is the number one rated cornerback and 13th overall prospect for the 2024 draft, which will be held in April in Detroit. DeJean from Audebolt, Iowa, made the announcement on social media. He credited head coach Kirk Ferentz for giving him an opportunity to play for his home state team and defensive coordinator Phil Parker for his development as a defensive back. He went on to thank his Iowa teammates and Hawkeye fans before ending the post with these words, "With that being said, I am declaring for the 2024 NFL Draft." DeJean had 2 interceptions and 5 pass breakups in 10 games during the 23 season, while not allowing a touchdown in 388 snaps. He also excelled as a punt returner, averaging 11.5 yards per attempt. During the 2022 season, DeJean had 5 interceptions and returned 3 of them for touchdowns. DeJean, listed as a junior on the Iowa roster, could have had 2 years of eligibility remaining. If DeJean ends up going in the first round as expected, it would be the 3rd straight year Iowa has had at least one player picked in the first 30 selections. Lucas Van Ness and linebacker Jack Campbell were picked by the Green Bay Packers and Detroit Lions in the first round last year, and center Tyler Linderbaum was selected number 25 overall by the Baltimore Ravens in 2022. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. My name is Rachel Thorson-Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.